Coming up this Friday, author Nick Jans will be presenting his book, A Wolf Called Romeo, at the Ketchikan Public Library. And joining me from Haines is author Nick Jans. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining me this morning. And you used to live in Juneau, but now you moved to Haines. What prompted that?
Oh, well, among other things, is just getting back to the Alaska I knew best. I spent 20 years in the Northwest Arctic, and where I'm living right now is still pretty citified by that standard. So it's just part of a. It was time for a change. You know, Juneau was a great place to live, and we enjoyed it. But we sure are enjoying the peace and quiet here, and a feeling of distance. We're 26 miles out the road, near where the Klahini and the Zirku rivers come together, and the neighbors make too much noise. It's probably the coyotes.
And your book, A Wolf Called Romeo, it's very unique, an interaction of a black wolf with domesticated dogs in Juneau, as well as interacting with people. And in trying to think of how to describe it, I guess to me it's a love story, but it's also more than that. Tell people a bit about what happened.
Well, even with all the pictures I have, thousands of them literally over years, to prove it happened, it still seems like a dream. It seems like something somebody made up. I mean, a 120-pound black wolf just shows up one day and starts trotting right up to people and their dogs and playing with them incredibly gently, especially considering that usually when wolves make the news around dogs in Alaska, it's that somebody got it. and it was just something that was totally remarkable. And it continued, and it was by his own choice. This wolf, for reasons nobody really knows, chose a completely different lifestyle and survival strategy, living right on the edge of people. And instead of socializing with a family group, i.e. pack, picked up dogs as surrogates of sorts, although I'm sure he must have known there was some sort of a difference, but it was just what he chose to do. And, you know, it was hard not to believe that we weren't looking at the archetypal wolf that came to lay down by our fire and became all the dogs that we have now.
And it is a unique animal. Explain a little bit, I guess, about your experience with wolves and how this one differed.
Well, of course, I lived in Eskimo villages for 20 years, and the big difference is that wolves really, in general, are very secretive and really don't like to be seen. There are occasional bold and curious wolves, but really, they tend to stay away from people, and if they are near people, they tend to be invisible. You know, if they get used to the idea that people aren't going to shoot at them and trap them, you know, places like Denali National Park or certain places along the Katmai Coast and so on, they can become to the point where they just don't really notice you and go about their business, neutrally habituated, we call it. But this wolf seemed to actually seek out not only canine, but as the years went on, certainly human contact as well, of some sort. And, I mean, to the point where, if I was skiing on the lake, I sometimes might look over my shoulder and there would be the wolf trotting along 50 yards behind me. And, of course, it took some getting used to. But then it was just something that was part of life there, and it went on for 6 years, which is an astounding amount of time. Because usually, you know, if you have contact with a wolf or with pretty much any wild animal, it's briefly and you don't see them again. You don't get to know that individual. And yet, during all this time, and this was the really remarkable part, is he remained a wild wolf. It wasn't like he was food conditioned and being fed and getting used to that whole idea. He didn't approach people for food. He hunted on his own. I picked apart his scats many times over the years and found what he was eating. And there was, you know, salmon bones, mink hair, the little soft quills that are part of a porcupine that aren't the sharp ones, goat hair, deer hair, so on.
And at the beginning, we kind of know where this is going to go. We know it won't be a happy ending.
No. You know, the first time he showed up, I looked out the window, and when I first saw that wolf, I said, the first thing I thought was, wow, there's a wolf. And I thought, oh, no, there's a wolf. You know, and there was really no way to deal with him. Everybody was sort of feeling their way on this. Because what do you do with a sociable wild wolf that is just really pretty much following the rules and was causing a lot less trouble than your average dumpster diving black bear? You know, it was there was nothing to do about it. But here's, you could look upon this as something inevitable and incredibly sad. But when you consider that one study showed that an average wild wolf in Denali National Park lives just 3 years. We're talking about with no human action as part of that, reducing that lifespan, 3 years. This wolf, when he died, was in his eighth year. That's the minimum it could have been. And so he more than doubled and was closing in on tripling the life of a wild wolf living in a preserve.
And during this, in the book, you share your views and experiences with wolves, give some research information as well as your opinions on who did things right and who did things wrong. It's a very, very personal story. And I sense, I guess, there's some anger in there.
Well, you know, I don't know if it's, I would not go so far as to say it was anger in the long sense of the word. At times, in the short sense of the word, there were. But you'll note in the book that there are times when I express anger at somebody doing something, and then I pull back and I say, on the other hand, here's another way of looking at it.
And I would agree with that.
And all along, it, you know, I realized it wasn't my wolf. It wasn't anybody's wolf, and it was just this unusual circumstance, and you're trying to figure out what the right thing to do. And of course, the standard answer is, well, stay away from it. And that's easy to say unless you have a wolf in your yard, which is certainly what we ended up with a lot of the time. He'd just be sitting out there waiting. What do you do, barricade yourself in your house? He's waiting for us to come out with our dogs. And I threw snowballs at him. I threw my ski poles at him. It didn't matter. And if when we decided to step back after that first few weeks of that winter, when we realized in 2003 that he was 2004 that he was going to stay, other people just stepped in. There was nothing to do. And the good news is that all in all, it went incredibly well for a long period of time, and everybody involved in this whole thing, the entire community and all the managing agencies, everybody was so forbearant and tolerant, and it seemed as if they were matching the wolf's tolerance. And really, it was just an unprecedented and completely unique event. I couldn't think of any other story, and I looked around for examples of a large wild predator living outside of a preserve that interacted so long and so peacefully with so many people.
And his real love was the dogs. And
absolutely. There's no doubt. And there were a number of dogs that he was very attracted to. But there were some people, too, for instance, a guy called Harry Robinson, a friend of mine. He wasn't a friend of mine at the time, but we became friends after. He sought out the wolf after the wolf had sought him out. I mean, he was just walking his dog like we all did, and all of a sudden he had a wolf there. And he was a regular guy and showed up every morning to walk his dog as he always had, and then there was a wolf. And for the next years, he kept going out, and the wolf kept accompanying him and his dog, Britain, and they would go for five-mile hikes together. They'd be gone for hours. And I saw not only Harry, but other people do this as well, where basically the wolf would fall into line behind the dogs, and off people would go somewhere with a wild wolf in tow. And sometimes he'd, veer off through the brush, they'd say, and go off hunting, if he sensed a hare or something. And photographer John Hyde saw him jump on and kill a beaver right in front of him, like, just a few feet away. I didn't even know the beaver was there, but the wolf sure did. And so on it went. If the wolf had been, there were all these management questions. What do you do? What's the right thing to do? And the Fish and Game toyed with different ideas, certainly, but they chose doing nothing. For a simple reason is, where's a wolf supposed to live? Well, Tongass National Forest, the largest national forest in the country, seems like a pretty appropriate place, and there, no one had gotten hurt. There were, over the years, three dogs disappeared, some total, that were attributed to him, and in two of those instances, nobody actually saw anything. And the area biologist at the time, Neil Barton, went out and investigated and could find no evidence that a dog had even been killed. It had just disappeared. Another case, it was in an area where several residents knew that there were several wolves around, and the owner who had the dog disappear didn't blame the wolf that people called Romeo. But at the same time, it was attributed to him. It was just, the whole thing was just one of these things. Even in Alaska, stuff like this just doesn't happen. Nowadays, Romeo's long gone, but there's two roads named after him in Juneau. He has a coffee named after him, and a seasonal beer from Alaskan Brewing in a town that likes its coffee and beer.
The other thing is, I follow the news, but oddly, I didn't know about this, and it wasn't a kept secret, and I'm sure there were, newspaper articles and stories, which, in part, that's what led to his demise. What was it like? And it seemed like sometimes maybe it was a little bit of a media circus, or at least photographer and people circus.
It certainly was a people and dog circus. At times, but almost all of it was residents. It didn't go viral. This was just before the age of social media. I mean, we had email and stuff. But I think if it had happened, if Romeo had showed up last winter, the videos would have gone viral on YouTube, and all this worldwide attention would have occurred. But it just didn't. And I wrote about the wolf a number of times over the years for Alaska Magazine. No one was keeping it a conscious secret. It just became a local phenomenon. Part of that was that the wolf was most visible and most often around in the winter, which isn't tourist season. And oftentimes, if you wanted to go out and see the wolf, you had to be out in pretty bad conditions. And sometimes it wasn't just out on the lake. It was it took some effort to be out there.
What was the general feeling from your book? It sounds like most people were very taken with it, but certainly there are people who, you know, the only good wolf is a dead wolf kind of attitude, or the people who are, you know, this is a spirit from whatever. I mean, there's various extremes in there. What was kind of the general overall feeling about this wolf?
Well, I don't think there was one. I mean, Juneau is like any Alaska town. You know, maybe a little more liberal leaning than most, and surely that was part of the reason the wolf was able to survive. But you know, there's always people who don't like wolves, and from the very first time he showed up, there were people. I had neighbors tell me it's the first time that steps in my yard, I'm going to plug him. And that was one of the things, was the incredible forbearance that even people who didn't like that wolf showed. And there was a general community respect that everybody showed. You know, while he wasn't anybody's wolf, he was certainly part of our extended community. You know, you couldn't explain his survival any other way. And you mentioned something earlier that, you know, publicity led to his demise. I'm not so sure of that, in that, you know, during that same time, there were dozens of wolves killed across Southeast and in Juneau that didn't have any publicity, and this one lived. So to say that he lived 2.5 times longer than a wild wolf does, typically, according to studies, isn't to say that this was something inevitable. That was saying it would be the same as saying, well, this guy went out and went salmon fishing along bear streams for 10 years, and he got mauled. Oh, that was inevitable.
Not okay, really. Yeah, and I guess that wasn't a good way to put it, but
right.
The person who ended up killing him was, you know, knew about him and was looking for that
surely,
trophy.
He surely did, but he also was a serial poacher, and the bears he shot, and he was convicted of killing 2 black bears illegally, and I'm sure there were others. That guy, who also had a pretty lengthy rap sheet, last time I checked, he was back in Pennsylvania and was doing some time in prison for copper pipe theft. You know, which is kind of a desperate thing to do when you need some money. He didn't care anyway, and he shot whatever he saw, and yeah, the wolf was accessible, but nonetheless, it couldn't have been that accessible to him, because it took him years to actually catch up with him. Romeo had a sixth sense about when he was safe and where he was safe and where he wasn't. Consider that one of his regular beats was across the downwind. We're talking about the target end of the shooting range, with, you know, plenty of motivated people, and actually would have been totally legal. But he crossed that shooting range all the time, and he seemed to know how to do it and how to avoid the wrong people.
And you, again, you've chosen to tell his story. What are you hoping? I guess, why did you decide to tell this story?
Well, there's a few things. One of which, it was this incredible experience, which still is something that to me was entirely transformative. That's one thing. Another is that there's so much just of the other kind of wolf story out there, where wolves just take a beating, you know, and are demonized. I mean, you know, Hollywood makes a movie, and you know, Liam Neeson is serving as a wolf guard up on the North Slope, where his main job is to stand guard with a scoped rifle for when, not if, the wolves attack the pipeline workers, which of course is ludicrous. You know, and then he and his whole group of fellow passengers on a plane are hunted down one by one and killed by a wolf pack. You know, this just goes on. Wolves are demonized. There's all these kind and gentle bears, you know, Yogi Bear, the Bernstein Bears, Winnie the Pooh, and there is no kind and gentle wolf. And yet we end up not with the descendants of bears at lying at our feet and being called man's best friend. They're creatures that are 99.98% identically genetically to wolves. Labradors, huskies, pugs, you name it. I mean, they're 99.98% wolf. And so it's just this, the other side of the story. But perhaps the most important thing of all to me is that as long as this wolf story gets told, he's alive. And he certainly was one of the things that overall I and a number of others truly loved and stood for, something that we all love Alaska for.
And he is memorialized.
There's a plaque out in the way to Nugget Falls, and it hasn't become a shrine where people leave flowers, and it hasn't been vandalized by the naysayers. It's just part of who Juno is.
And I was also very surprised at the ending. You know, I kind of knew where things would go, but very different person, I guess, than who I thought would have killed him. And I guess Romeo's final fate.
Well, it turned out the guy was really from Pennsylvania, and he was leaving behind a troubled past, to put it mildly, back there. And he'd been in Juneau for several years, and pretty much continued the kind of bad habits he had, and then when he turned around and left Juneau, he ended up back there, and ended up back in trouble with the law. You know, I don't know. I would say it wasn't really surprising, because everybody else knew better, and finally, I guess it's understandable that it was really an outsider, and his buddy from back in Pennsylvania who did this. And you know, I've in my past I've seen so many dead wolves. I've killed more wolves than most wolf haters have ever seen. And frankly, if I had to do it over again, I would take that back. And you ask me another reason to tell this story. It's sort of the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. This man has penance done, and penance more will do, I suppose.
You also have many pretty amazing photographs in this book.
Well, I would have had many, many more, except that half the time when I saw the wolf outside, I stayed inside, because I was trying to set a good example, and when I didn't, it was simple failure of will. It was from a photographic standpoint, it was absolutely the experience of a lifetime, and I could have made much, much more of it. And I look at the dates on the pictures, and after about 2004, this dramatic falling off, because I just didn't go out. And when I just took my camera and actually deliberately avoided places where the wolves were, where the wolf was with my dogs. I used to, oh, the wolf's out there, and I'd go skiing somewhere else, and look for a little window to duck out. So I spent a lot of time actually avoiding the opportunity, which was something that I would have. If I'd been out up some Brooks Range Valley, like where I used to live, it would have been a totally different story. And there was no right or wrong way. There was nothing you could do to save him, either by doing nothing or by doing something. It didn't make any difference.
Well, thank you very much for joining me this morning. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention, either about this book or other projects?
Well, anybody who's interested in the book can look at my new website, nickjams.com, and there's some thoughtful information about writing the book and an author question and answer set about it, and a few photos. right now I'm kind of exhausted, frankly, by this whole project. It was 7 years in the living and 3 years in the writing. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, was trying to tell this story the right way. And it was technically very, very challenging to make all the parts of it work, because it didn't have the standard shape of a rising action and a falling. It was a series of just it was actually sort of like a Venn diagram. It was just these circular motions that overlapped themselves, and all these different elements that had to be woven into it. And it was just a tremendously difficult thing to do, and it was emotionally a difficult thing for me to do. But writing is the way I make sense of the world. It's the way I make sense to myself. It's a way of explaining something that I want to understand better to myself more than it is to others. And finally, I don't have any easy answers. I don't even know if I have any answers at all.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you very much, Maria.
Author Nick Jans, again, he will be at the Ketchikan Public Library this Friday at 6 p.m. to present his book, A Wolf Called Romeo.